You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with four guests who each offer a unique lens into the upcoming historic Fellowship of Reconciliation's Centennial Conference at Seebeck, Washington, where they'll be exploring the past, present, and future of the largest, oldest interfaith peace organization in the United States.
This conference should be regarded as a game changer, where we start to create that movement of movements that leads to what so many people have wished for so long. This conference has that potential. I want to see it happen.
This is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Aguano, Golizikawoba, welcome and greetings to you in the Penobscot language. I'm coming to you from my home in the Don Land. It's a gray and cloudy day here in Bunawapskeag territory in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And I'm joined today by my radiant co-host who is bringing the sun and some amazing guests today. Hello, Rivera.
Well, hello, Sherry. We have a number of guests. Actually, this is an all-time record on Love and Revolution Radio and also my recording experience as a radio host. We have four guests for you today to talk about the Fellowship of Reconciliation, their Centennial Conference, and the Seebeck Conference that's happening up in Washington in the beginning of July. We're going to talk with Tom Hastings, who is a lifelong peace activist. He's also a professor of conflict resolution at Portland State University and on the communication committee of the NAACP. We're going to talk to Adam Vogel, who is a leader in the Students United for Nonviolence at Portland State University. And along with our other guest, Michael Colvin, he is on the Fellowship for Reconciliation's National Conference. Both Michael and Adam are on the planning committee for the Seebeck Conference, and they're going to tell you about the intentions of this conference, which are pretty awesome, I have to admit, having had a sneak preview. Our last guest on the show today is Carla Elizarraras. She is a board member for the Inland Congregation United for Change, ICUC, which is based in Southern California, and she is also part of the PICO National Network. So welcome to all of our guests, welcome to all of our listeners, and Sherry, why don't you kick us off with the first questions?
Thank you, Rivera. Michael, let's go right to you. I would love it if you would give our listeners an overview of this reconciliation process that you're engaged in and about the organization that it's tied to.
The Fellowship of Reconciliation is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. That makes it the oldest social action and peace and social justice organization in the world. It was pivotal in the founding of the American Civil Liberties Union back in 1922 and brought James Lawson into the civil rights movement in the early 60s when he trained the Fisk University students at Nashville in how to conduct the sit-ins and so on at the lunch counters in Nashville, Tennessee. So we are at Seebeck celebrating our 58th anniversary of holding conferences there, but this is really the first time that this is an all-national conference. So we have people actually not only from the United States, but from some far-flung places in the world like India coming to be a part of this to talk about nonviolence and nonviolent struggle and organizing nonviolently in the current political situation we find ourselves.
Great. And it's an amazing history that FOR has, and I can imagine it's quite a challenge to coordinate this conference and to bring such an incredible organization into new territory. Adam, will you explain a little bit about the choice to focus the CBEC conference around civil resistance?
So yes, the reason that we are focusing on civil resistance is because we have an understanding in the world today that things are not going the way that they're supposed to be going, and there's a lot of injustice and corruption. And so what it really comes down to is we understand how nonviolence can change the way that the world works. And in order to increase the amount of knowledge and understanding that people can take away with them from this conference, we've actually invited in some of the top people in nonviolence, and nonviolent change for the world comes from having people leave our conference with an understanding of how nonviolence works. And we've really focused it on bringing young people into the fold this year, because we are handing them a world that needs a lot of work. And so the civil resistance part of this is our children certainly understand what's going on in the world and what we're handing them. And the four conferences can give them the ability to take this information out into the world so that they can create those positive changes that we need.
Thank you, Adam. Tom, I know that you have a long history as an activist and have also been deeply engaged in nonviolence work. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences and how they might tie into what's going on here and what you think the benefits of that might be?
Sure. The practice of nonviolence for a long, long time was sort of a confusing mixture of what is known as principled nonviolence and strategic nonviolence. And for a lot of us, I'm an old guy. I'm a senior citizen. My first arrest for nonviolent action was back 30-some years ago, 33 years ago, actually. And before that, 50 years ago, I was a resistor to the war in Vietnam. So this understanding, I've watched it happen. I've tried to learn about this. And over a period of time, we're acquainted with case study after case study, but finally we have actual serious research into why this works. And as Adam said, we're also going to find out how it works. So the research points out both of these. The practitioners will say how, and the researchers will say why. So that's what makes this conference so important. This is the first time I'm aware when we have this caliber of top-level researchers and practitioners come together for a conference.
It certainly is very exciting. And, you know, I want to ask Carla a question. You are one of the younger generations coming into this conference and this gathering. Will you speak a little bit about your experience and your interest coming to this conference and being a part of this and sharing your wisdom as well as tapping to some of this knowledge that Tom just spoke about?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you guys all for giving me the opportunity to be part of such a great group. I've been involved in community organizing since I was in high school. I started right around when I was 16, and I first got introduced into community organizing. And so for me, it's been such a big change in my life to learn how to be an empowered young leader who at first, when I first got involved, was super shy, had no idea about my rights as a citizen of this country. As a resident in my local area, I've constantly been told by my local leaders that because I didn't have a vote, that I had no power. And so learning about local policies and laws with community organizing, being pretty much like my second family, with ICUC, I've been focusing a lot on doing that myself and becoming a community organizer myself to teach students, other young leaders, how to change policy and locally on a regional level and on the state level, to resist all of the corrective power that's not necessarily going in their favor and helping them become the best that they can be, become successful, be able to get a good education, and things that just are holding a lot of our people back, especially minorities.
Michael, I want to go back to you for a moment. The conference seeks to replace war, racism, and economic justice with nonviolence, equality, peace, and justice. As you know, Rivera and I are both very involved in this work on a broad spectrum of issues and in a number of ways, including teaching strategic nonviolence courses. And the purpose of this radio show is to highlight programs, organizations, activities, ideas that illustrate a way forward that is representative of the way of life that we all want to live. It's a peace-based, heart-based, love-based revolution. It's about creating something other than what we've seen. It's giving people a model to aim towards. So we're really interested in examples of what does peace, equality, and justice look like? Can you give us some examples of the types of things that you're talking about when you talk about equality, peace, and justice?
Well, I think the important thing for us to remember here in the United States is that what it means to have peace and social justice is something that we've been working at for generations, and yet having some real struggles having that become actual in anybody's life, particularly the life of our entire society. And part of that problem, I think, rests on our shoulders as activists kind of on the left side of the spectrum, that we get so focused on our own particular issue that we're concerned about, whether it's Black Lives Matter and other issues related to people of color, or environmental issues, or Native American rights, gender equality, all of those kinds of things. We all have our pet projects, and being able to see how those are connected and beginning to build connections between those various movements really is the key to unlocking social justice in this country in a very powerful and meaningful way that will involve many, many people.
I think that's a really wonderful point, Michael, about the need to broaden our perspective, to take a look around side to side at our friends and neighbors who are working in movements for change. And I like to always mention the movement of movements, which is this thriving ecosystem of multiple movements, as many of which you mentioned, some of which Carla mentioned, that are working for change and share a commitment to nonviolence, to justice, to equality, to building respect in our world, to building a world that works for all of us. Adam, I'd like to ask you the question of how you see the role of training in nonviolence. You work with many organizations, including Campaign Nonviolence, the Students United for Nonviolence, and you're on this planning committee for the CPEC conference, all of which have a strong emphasis on the role of training in building vital and successful movements for change in our communities. Can you speak a little bit about what you think the real values are in getting this kind of training?
The reality is that most people in America aren't even aware that there's a different way to be in the world. We're brought up in school learning that war is okay, that the inequalities that we deal with are okay. And the training that nonviolence brings says, you know what, there's a different way to be in the world. And we're going to show you how to do that. And with this ability to understand that there is a different way in the world, it gives people the opportunity to be their better selves. And that's why the training is so important, because in order to have a better world, we have to be our better selves. And all the organizations that I'm involved with are geared towards helping people become what this world needs them to be in order for it to thrive. And CBEC is going to be a wonderful experience for people who, many of the youth have not dealt with any of this, so it's going to be pretty amazing.
One of the things that gives me some hope about events like this and so many things that we encounter in this work is the promise of bringing people together. We're living in a time where fundamentalism has reached beyond the boundaries of religion. It is embedded into so many aspects of our lives, where you see even people who are activists who are working to theoretically create a better world are so deeply entrenched and siloed in their individual issues that they're unable to see beyond what their particular focus is. And as a result, we're becoming more and more divided in some ways at a time when unity is as vital to our continued existence as air and water. And so, Tom, I would like you to talk about the importance of creating unity among these movements without homogenizing them. How do we do that? How do we create unity without homogenization, without filtering down any of the individual issues that people are concerned with?
In 25 words or less, yes. I think that's a real challenging question, but I also think that honoring our diversity at the same time that we're seeking unity is important. So the workshop that I'm going to be a part of, Christine and Allison Allenhall, is being a white ally. And what I've found over the decades is that when I'm a good white ally, all of a sudden things happen that I had no idea were even possible. And the most concrete example is a number of us basically throwing ourselves at this Navy thermonuclear command facility in Wisconsin and Michigan, just desperately trying to get this thing shut down and failing and failing and failing. I mean, I went to prison for it and, you know, have two felonies on my record for nonviolent dismantlement of part of it. And what happened was a number of us sort of hit the pause button on that resistance in order to spend about 3 years really focusing on supporting Native American treaty rights, the Anishinaabe struggle to reaffirm and be able to practice their treaty rights in northern Wisconsin. So we trained in hundreds of nonviolent witness for peace, and we were out at the boat landings with the fishers from the tribes. And this was serious threats against the tribes. There were pipe bombs, shotguns, and we stuck with that, not with a sense of there's going to be a quid pro quo, but at the end of it, after the tribes had not only won all legal battles all the way up to the Supreme Court, but they had also won the approval of more than 90% of the citizens of Wisconsin, which was a complete reversal of the original position. Then, after all of this sort of major victory snatched from what looked like complete defeat, then the tribes said, oh, okay, we won this. Now, they informed us, we are going to join your struggle. And that was a huge surprise to us. And the Navy had just said, we are going to keep this facility open for at least another 35 years. When the tribes said, we're going to join your struggle, the Navy basically caved and said, never mind. And they shut it down. They went away. They completely took apart this whole many miles of this command facility and the two bases that served it in Michigan and Wisconsin, and now there are elk roaming where that used to be. That, to me, was an object lesson in you be a good ally and you never know what might happen. This is the unity that we need, and you can't get there by saying, oh, why don't you come over and help us with our struggle? You have to get there by saying, look, there's injustice happening over here. Let's jump in and be of service if we can.
That's a powerful story, Tom, and it's amazing to think about your long lifetime of doing this work and the wisdom that you bring to it. I like to joke that your felony conviction is older than I am. Carla, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the role of allyship and what's becoming known as intersectionality throughout the movements, how connecting these dots and seeing how we have common cause with one another plays a role in the work that you're doing in your community organizing work.
First of all, I think a big focus that ever since the December 7th shooting that San Bernardino suffered, we've been getting a lot of backlash in our community about being a plain out violent city. And there has been a lot of violence. It's a common day issue, but there's not enough focus on the good things that are happening in our city. And that's because that's so much having to do with the media always putting up the negatives.
I completely agree with you about how the media spins stories. We saw it in Ferguson, we saw it in Baltimore, we saw it recently here where I live in Albuquerque with an incident that just happened, that they tend to love to talk a lot about the violence and really kick people down a lot too without holding up the really courageous, powerful action that communities are organizing to address their problems with their own local wisdom, skill, knowledge of what they face. What I really wanted to ask, though, is in the issues that you're dealing with in San Bernardino, I imagine that there's not just one. It's not just the violence or the police brutality. There's other things that intersect with that issue. And how have you found support in looking at the complexity of the issues, the way that, say, poverty is related to crime, is related to the war on drugs, is related to racism, is related to militarism? And what's your perspective on how we can go about dealing with such a complex field of change?
The thing that we do in my community organization, and I say based community organization, I must say, it's we do something that we like to put our faith into action. And we unlock the power of the people by not just letting them speak on the issues, but also uniting clergy, uniting our students, our parents, every stakeholder in our community that we can engage in. We like to strengthen them, give them the tools that they need, and talk about the issues that, you know, they're dealing on a day-to-day basis. Immigration, lack of access to health, dealing with mass incarceration, and lack of quality education. So we focus a lot more on what it is that our people truly care about. We advocate for them, and we also let them speak on what matters to them the most. We have them go up to their local leaders and express to them what they want to see change in their community. And instead of just us advocating for them, you know, they're able to do it themselves and feel powerful doing it. So I think it's really important focusing on youth, because they are the now. They are the ones that are often not given that voice, not given that opportunity to share what's going on in their minds, what do they need. And once they're given that opportunity, there is so much that they have to say, and it's like a whole new door that opens for them. And I feel like it's going in the right direction rather than not keeping them engaged, thinking that we know what they're feeling, what they really want to see. It's a big difference getting our youth involved in civic engagement and education and everything that they're experiencing.
That is really great to hear that. And Sherry, I'm just wondering, as I'm passing the mic back to you, if this mirrors some of the work that you do with the youth in your area too.
Well, I actually was thinking about the entire reconciliation process and trying to wrap my head around how this comes into play, but I'll table that for a moment. Certainly when you give people the opportunity to have voice, and that when Tom was talking about what it means to be a good ally, what it means to be a good ally is not to speak on behalf of people, but to provide a platform for their voices to be heard. That's one of the things that's essential to being an ally. Another thing that's part of that process is that people whose voices have been suppressed for a very long time, when they first start to try to speak, oftentimes one of two things will happen. It'll come out very soft and timid, and it'll take time for them to build up the strength in their voice again because those muscles are weak from having not been used. Other times it will come out in a very strong, powerful way, explosively, because there's so much force that has to be used to push that voice beyond the boundaries that have been suppressing it. And so working with people to help them to develop that voice, to help them to either strengthen those muscles or to even out and balance the force that's been required to move beyond those boundaries is essential, because in order for us to be heard, we have to be able to clearly articulate what it is that we're experiencing. We have to be able to clearly articulate how we're impacted in our lives in real ways. And so I think that that piece is really important. And my next question actually is about this process of reconciliation. And I'm wondering, how closely do you follow the standard process for some of these reconciliation programs? There have been truth and reconciliation programs that have gone on all over the world. Certainly the reconciliation that occurred in South Africa. There is a huge reconciliation, truth and reconciliation process that unfolded in Canada. Here with the Wabanaki tribes, we're engaged in a truth and reconciliation process as well. And the first piece of that is telling the truth. And so how do we engage that process of reconciliation? And Michael, I would like you to answer this question as best you can. How do we engage that process of reconciliation, staying true to the name of the fellowship, and begin moving things forward in a way that's productive and in a way that honors that everybody's been impacted by these hurtful behaviors, not just the people who are the oppressed, not just the oppressors, but even the witnesses? Everybody has been impacted by the trauma and the inequality, the injustice of our history. So that's a lot for you to unpack, Michael, but I would like you to just at least address the issue of reconciliation and how the process of reconciliation comes into play in the work that you're doing with the people that you're meeting with.
Well, it's actually a good point to broach at this moment. I think historically, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, I'm not sure exactly what their idea of reconciliation was 100 years ago, but historically, it has been kind of the traditional protest approach to creating and stimulating social change, but with a kind of faith-based aspect to that. I think over time, though, reconciliation has been understood differently, and certainly now it is being understood quite differently. And there is a process that I've been involved with in some of the community organizing that I've done around storytelling. So each of us has our own story of the things that are affecting us, our lives, in various ways. Maybe struggles over housing. It may be struggles over finding economic equality. It may be gender issues. Those personal stories are what really create the interests that we have in social action. And for us to be able to bridge to somebody else's understanding means being able to listen to their story. And listening is the key. So one of the things that I would like to do at the conference is build in a process of storytelling and listening. And I'm going to be, I think we're going to be asking people to approach strangers, people they've never known before, maybe even people are uncomfortable with, and sit down and have a, what we would call a relational meeting with them. where we share our personal stories and we begin to make connections. And out of those connections, we build strength and understanding that can really move a movement forward.
Hold on, hold on to your vision. Live it, speak it, for the children will listen.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
My sisters and brothers, won't you rise to your dreams? For the whole world needs you to live your liberty.
This week in our Nonviolence Minute, it only makes sense to focus on the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is the largest, oldest interfaith peace organization in the United States. They've been working for peace, justice, and nonviolence since 1915. And as an interfaith organization, FOR USA's mission is to organize, train, and grow a diverse movement that welcomes all people of conscience to end structures of violence and war, and to create peace through the transformative power of nonviolence. The Fellowship of Reconciliation started in 1915, after a 1914 ecumenical conference was held in Switzerland by Christians seeking to prevent the outbreak of war in Europe. However, before the conference could end, World War I had started, and those present had to return to their respective countries. At the railroad station in Germany, two of the participants, Henry Hodgkin, an English Quaker, and Friedrich Siegmund Schultz, a German Lutheran, pledged to find a way of working for peace even though their countries were at war. Out of this pledge came the beginning of the Fellowship of Reconciliation in December of 1914. The U.S. branch was founded 1 year later. Since then, the Fellowship of Reconciliation has grown to have branches and affiliated groups in over 50 countries on every continent. Today, the membership includes Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, indigenous religious practitioners, Baha'i, and people of other faith traditions, as well as those with no formal religious affiliation. Here are just a few of the many efforts that FOR has been involved in its 100 years of working for peace and justice. From 1916 to 17, FOR helped to organize the National Civil Liberties Bureau, which is now known as the ACLU, and they also supported World War I conscientious objectors. In the 1920s and 30s, FOR helped to strengthen the labor movement, particularly under the leadership of A.J. Mustey. In the 1940s, FOR encouraged nonviolent resistance to World War II and led the struggle against the internment of Japanese Americans. European FOR members rescued Jews and other political refugees who were fleeing the Nazis. In addition, as if this wasn't enough, FOR sponsored an interracial team on the first Freedom Ride through the Jim Crow South. Moving into the 1950s, FOR worked with Martin Luther King Jr. during the Montgomery bus boycott and held workshops for nonviolence throughout the South and helped to form the Congress of Racial Equality. In addition to organizing against the Vietnam War in the 1960s, FOR also made contact with the Vietnamese Buddhist pacifist movement and sponsored the world tour of the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh. In the 1970s, FOR sought to reverse the Cold War and the arms race with campaigns, marches, educational projects, and civil disobedience. In the 1980s, they took a lead in initiating the Nuclear Freeze campaign in cooperation with other groups. FOR also initiated a United States and USSR reconciliation program, including people-to-people exchanges, artistic and educational resources, teach-ins, and conferences. During this productive period, FOR led nonviolence training seminars in the Philippines prior to the nonviolent overthrow of the Marcos dictatorship in the People Power Revolution. In the last 3 decades alone, the Fellowship of Reconciliation has been involved in peace, healing, and justice initiatives in Iraq, Bosnia, Colombia, Puerto Rico, and more nations. They have also worked on issues of poverty, war, militarism, racial justice, gun violence, and environmental justice. As the Fellowship of Reconciliation celebrates its centennial year, we can almost trace the arc of social justice through their history. For indeed, FOR has been entwined in nearly every struggle for peace and justice in the last 100 years. As Coretta Scott King says, the Fellowship of Reconciliation has been in the forefront of the nonviolent struggle for peace with justice. What is important about FOR is what it stands for, and that is a courageous dedication to the liberation of humanity from the triple evils of poverty, racism, and violence. Know your nonviolent history. It might change your life.
For there is power in your freedom. There is hope within your dreams. There is movement.
This week's featured music is by Heather Houston. It's called Now Is the Time. You can find her soulful and beautiful music at www.heatherhoustonmusic.com. And now, let's return to our discussion.
We have so many fantastic presenters at the conference this year. Erica Chenoweth is going to be there, and she's the number one researcher in nonviolence and a hero of mine. So I'm super excited about her being there. And Tom, of course, is going to be there talking about white allyship. And we also have quite a few other people. Jamila Raqib is going to be there, and she's going to be sharing some wonderful information with us. And also, we're going to have quite a few opportunities for people to spend time just getting to know one another and building community. That's a huge part of the conference, is actually building community so that we can, when we go out and we do our work in the field, we can be bold and know that we have people that are standing behind us that believe in what we believe, that believe in equality, that believe that the world deserves more than what it has right now, and the people of the world deserve more than what they're getting. And we get that by being bold and going out and working towards that. And so what we've done is we've brought amazing presenters to this conference, but the real value of the conference is bringing the youth together who can meet, get to know one another, and then make their plans for a better future. I mean, we have probably 250 people that will attend, and there's going to be relationships built there that are going to go on to create beautiful, beautiful things over the next year, the next 5 years, the next 10 years. So the goal of this conference is to build relationship and build community so that we can expand the community to a point where it's not hundreds, but it's thousands, and then it's millions. And then the entire country sees, hey, wait, what are those people doing? Oh, that looks so much better than what's going on right now. Let's check that out. And so although this is just a single event, the potential for where it's going to go is enormous. And I'm so excited to be a part of this and part of the planning of it. And I guess the biggest takeaway from this conference is going to be the friendships that are made there.
I think that's vitally important. And it's certainly at the core of most of the work that we're doing. One of the things that I teach in my workshops is that the importance of being able to close the gaps that exist between us. We do that by building relationships, by sitting down with each other, looking each other in the eye, talking with each other breath to breath and heart to heart. Now, Tom, I know that you've had a lot of experience with relationship building as well, and I would love for you to talk a little bit about the importance of relationship building, the closing of these gaps and these divisions between us, and how that's vital to our ability to be able to move forward.
Thanks, Sherry. I would like to put in that in the context of an additional commercial for CBEC, and that is that this is a really family-friendly opportunity. They have childcare for pretty much every event, very kid-friendly, very family-friendly, and that adds to the diversity. As a single dad, for years, it was very challenging for me to find events that I could go to and feel really comfortable. Frankly, the most comfortable I ever felt were powwows. It's really tough for families, for single parents, et cetera, to find events that are so welcoming, and CBEC really, really is. It adds to that diversity in that way. So that's one piece of it. The other piece I want to go back to is the history. All of the relational work is more than, so what have you done for me lately? It goes back in time. You have to establish a reliability, a dependability, a commitment, and FOR has that commitment in many ways that are not even really understood by the movement still today. So, for example, one of the people I've been working with over the years is Reverend James Lawson, who was arguably the most important intellectual African-American pillar of the civil rights movement. And when he was asked by Dr. King to come from India, where he had been studying Gandhi and nonviolence in the 1950s, to help with the next phase of the civil rights movement beginning in 1960, Lawson, who was already enrolled in a divinity school, he was going to come back and finish getting his divinity degrees and then go off to be a minister. He said, okay, I will go where you want me to go. I just need to figure out how to make it possible. And it was the Fellowship of Reconciliation who stepped in and said, we'll pay. They created a position out of thin air. And they said to Reverend Lawson, we will pay you to be a field organizer in Nashville. Lawson went there, and he began the most robust series of nonviolent direct action trainings ever, and basically trained in these, and I'll kind of look back at something that Carla said earlier, these powerless university kids, these powerless college kids, all African-American with a few white allies, and he trained them. Lawson trained them, and that would have been impossible without the Fellowship of Reconciliation basically figuring out how to divert scarce funding to support this man while he did this project. That was absolutely crucial to the entire civil rights movement, made it, basically brought it into the next level. And these are the lessons. I really have to also sort of echo and reaffirm what you say about truth is the first piece. One of the women with whom I'm doing my workshop is Joanne Hardesty, leader of the local NAACP here. And she criticizes those official organizations who come and say, well, let's just figure out how to get along with the black community in town here. And she said, wait. Before we have reconciliation, we have to have truth. And so she's been organizing along those lines. It's made a tremendous difference. The Fellowship of Reconciliation is, again and again, an exemplar in setting the stage for this, and I would encourage people to get involved.
I would echo some of what you say, Tom, about, or actually probably everything you say, about the importance of trainings and gatherings like this in terms of those relationships that we build that deepen and broaden over time. That, you know, that was my experience going to the James Lawson Institute in 2014, which was Reverend Lawson's 8-day intensive to train mostly young people, but not exclusively, in this kind of civil resistance and strategic nonviolence, married with a deep commitment to the principles as well. That's where I met you. And from meeting you, you brought Sherry and I together, and Adam as well was a part of that up at Students United for Nonviolence. And we create a web of relationships that really reaches out to lift up and support this an entire movement. And it's really a beautiful phenomenon when we look carefully at it. Carla, I'd love to ask you what most excites you about coming up to the CBEC conference in Washington this July 1st through 4th. Are you going to see old friends there that you know already? Are you looking forward to meeting new people? What's most intriguing to you about this event coming up?
I think the thing I'm looking most forward to is getting to build new relationships, obviously, have those one-to-ones with people that have a common vision with me throughout the entire country, not just on the local level, even on the state level. and be able to just have these courageous conversations, even just on race, because that's such a, it's so important that we do focus on building the relationships with people we sometimes don't think we have commonalities with. And, you know, at the end of the day, when we end up having those conversations, we realize there are these values that we have. There are these principles, common values and common principles that we all share. Yet there's other things that, you know, are telling us, society is telling us that we should not look at our commonalities and even our differences. And so learning from that, and then taking some of the resources that we can get, bringing them back home and sharing the experience with my community and empowering the, my youth out here in San Bernardino and in the Inland Empire. That's what I'm looking most forward to.
I want to go back to your two primary presenters that are coming to the conference. One of the things that you talked about was having these world-class researchers be a part of this process, and everybody within the field of nonviolence is familiar with Erica Chenoweth's name and with the work that she's done. And maybe not everybody is as familiar with Jamila Raqib's history and her contributions. Michael, can you tell us a little bit about what you hope that she offers to you at this event and about some of the work that she's done to contribute to the field of nonviolence?
Jamila Raqib, she's quite young and yet has been assisting Jean Sharp, who is the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution in Boston, for a number of years. She is going to bring, I think, to the conference a lot of the newer research that the Albert Einstein Institution has been doing. And she's specifically going to be doing a workshop around the idea of civilian-based defense. And then Erica Chenoweth, her workshop is going to be dealing with how to confront and deal with violent flanks in a movement. Both of those workshops, I think, have some aspects of timing involved. There are things coming up right around the same time as CBEC, serendipitously, coincidentally. The week following the CBEC conference will be the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, and 2 weeks following the CBEC conference will be the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. And certainly at the Democratic Convention, we're going to see, I think, some nonviolent activity going on. I know of groups that are planning to have actions happening at that convention, and I see the rest of summer and fall moving into further actions as we go. So we just are going to be blessed, I think, by an opportunity to actually plan and see a way of using strategic nonviolence to hopefully address some of the issues that we'll be confronting later in the year and in the months ahead. So what Jamila, to get back to your original question, is going to contribute, I think, is a really youthful or young person's voice to this process. She is a ethnically an Afghani woman raised in the United States. And so she does speak Pashtun and a number of other languages and brings a kind of international perspective that some of the other presenters don't have maybe as much direct contact with.
Having met Jamila and having a deep admiration for her, she's an old soul in a young body, that's for sure, and a really incredible human being. Someone who came to the field of nonviolent struggle with a healthy dose of skepticism about its capacity. And so when she's for her to be in the position that she's in and for her to speak with such clarity and focus around both the challenges that face the use of nonviolent action and the capacity, the phenomenal capacity that Erica Chenoweth has actually demonstrated with Maria Stephan in terms of the empirical data of how successful nonviolent struggle has been. It's a really incredible thing to have her speak, especially on the topic of civilian defense, especially right now, as all of our presidential candidates, no matter how you slice them, have a foreign policy that is built on war and militarism and imperialism, basically. That civilian-based defense is a nonviolent alternative to that entire paradigm, one that has been tested and shown to be effective around the world, and one that we are virtually clueless about here in the United States. So I think this is a very exciting opportunity that's coming up at the CBEC conference to hear from Jamila about this subject. Michael, what can people look forward to if they are not able to attend in person? Are there going to be videos available afterwards or anything that's live streamed that people should know to tune into?
We are planning on having live streaming via YouTube for at least the keynote addresses, and hopefully if we can get enough folks involved with it to do live streaming of some of the workshops, because some of the workshops are going to be as good probably as the keynote addresses, at least from what I'm picking up. And so the live streaming then will be tied in with the ability to ask presenters questions from wherever a person is using a Twitter feed at FORCBEC, or the hashtag FORCBEC. That would be one way to do it, or #DandelionInsurrection is the other way of giving questions to the presenters through a kind of live feed. Then those same videos will be available afterwards on YouTube.
So thank you for that, Michael, and I know that I'm always tickled and thrilled that the Dandelion Instruction novel that I wrote is being such an inspiration that we're going to use it as a hashtag during the conference. I want to just remind the listeners of these remarkable guests that we're speaking with, who are all part of bringing this CBEC conference to you, either virtually online or in person in Washington during July 1st through 4th. We're speaking with Carla Eli-Zararas, who is a board member for the Inland Congregation United for Change, based in Southern California. Also with Michael Colvin, who, along with Adam Vogel, are both on the planning committee for the FORCBEC conference. And with Tom Hastings, who is a professor of conflict resolution at Portland State University, a lifelong peace activist, and on the communication committee of the NAACP. I want to just open it up, Sherry, if you want to take us into the closing round of remarks of what people should think about as we're leaving the show.
So we've heard a lot from all of our speakers on some of the issues that will be addressed at the CBEC conference. And I'm wondering if we can just go through one more time with each speaker, starting with Michael, and give you each 1 minute to tell us what you hope the greatest takeaway is from this event that's coming up.
My hope is that this conference might be a way of a start at uniting the various movements for social change in this country so that we can have a much greater voice in the future weeks and months ahead following the conference.
Thank you. How about you, Adam?
When I think of the CBEC conference, what I really hope to have is a building of community with like-minded people who have a diversity that increases everybody else's knowledge about the world and about the possibilities of creating a nonviolent future. The people that are coming to this event are just so diverse and have so much knowledge and so much understanding of a better world. and they can envision it and they can see it so clearly and they express it so well. And my goal or my hope for this event is every single person that comes there is going to leave with friendships. They're going to leave with partnerships. They're going to leave with a new understanding that we can change this world and we can do it together. We can do it in our own communities. We can do it as a community.
Tom, what are your final comments? What do you wish for with the CBET conference on the Fellowship of Reconciliation?
So what I want is 10 years from now, people will look back at this conference and say, that was the launch of a murmuration of movements, to use Rivera's sort of tool of creating movements, and to really create that, this conference should be regarded as a game changer, where we start to create that movement of movements that leads to what so many people have wished for so long. Jesse Jackson called it Rainbow Coalition. There have been many other names for it. This conference has that potential. I want to see it happen.
Thank you, Tom. Carla, how about you? What is it that you wish to come away from this week with, other than renewed friendships and tools? What do you hope in the long term will be the outcome of this conference?
I think, to me, the thing that I would like to come out of this is that we have a more solidarity nationwide. And so by having all these groups, all these different groups of people come together, build on values of love and peace, that we focus more on that, and how can I put this, use all of our love and our peace to strategically think through how can we work together to bring to focus on the issues that are facing our local communities, whether it be health, violence, whatever the issue may be, but that we focus on the relationships we're going to be building at this conference, and to also make use of these friendships and relationships that we're going to be building, and we can continue them for years and years to come.
Thank you all for sharing these thoughts and insights, your hopes and visions for this conference coming up, this historic conference, the 100th anniversary centennial conference of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Thank you for sharing so much about this historic event coming up.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution. Love, love, love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our amazing guests and to my co-host, Mr. Vera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is also performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
You can also find out more about the CBET conference happening July 1st through 4th in Washington State, including who's speaking, the live stream links, and registration information at www.forcbec.org. That's S-E-A as in the C. Thanks to my ever awesome co-host, Sherry Mitchell, whom you can follow on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. Special shout out this week to one of our friends in Florida who has actually gotten it on her local radio station this week. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. This week, we had four amazing guests that talked with us about the importance of connecting with the work that moves you, and then building relationships and networks, and creating unity in the movement of movements. What is the work of your heart, listeners? Perhaps you can look beyond your individual focus and see how you can reach out and build relationships with someone from outside by the time we talk to you next week.